If you want to, you can open your Bibles to the book of Genesis, right there at the beginning of the Old Testament. It's where we'll be spending most of our time together today. As we continue to look at some of the great characters, both men and women, of the Old Testament. And today, it just works out that Mother's Day is today, and we happen to be looking at a woman, so God in His providence helped me out on that one just a little bit. But we're going to look today at Sarah and her story from her introduction all the way to her burial is found in Genesis chapter 11, verse 27 through the end of chapter 23. This morning, we're not going to be able to look at every aspect of her life. There's just too much information, even though it's interesting to me. As I put together my list of these big characters from the Old Testament, I was trying to think about some of the main people. And I've been surprised as I've gone back through and looked, like with Samuel, for example. Samuel, I think of him as a main character, and yet he's really a supporting role in the stories of Saul and David. And even Sarah fits in that category a little bit, though she is a prominent woman from the Old Testament story in the line of the seed, really, she's a supporting character in the story of Abraham. And so we'll be picking and choosing some of the texts here in Genesis chapters 11 through 23 as we look at certain events from her life and see what lessons we can draw out of the example of Sarah and the things that she went through and how she handled them and see what we can apply to ourselves today as we seek to walk with the Lord. Let's begin with some general and background information about this woman. First, I need to observe that she goes by two names in the Genesis account. And I wanted to do that first so that we're not getting confused as we're seeing two different names talking about this same character, this same woman. The first name that she had that was given to her at birth was the name Sarai, which means princess. And later on, her name was going to be changed by God from Sarai to Sarah. It's very similar in English, and it's interesting in the Hebrew, it's also very similar. In fact, the word Sarah is functioning as a proper noun, the name of a person, means noble woman, even a princess or a noble lady. And you might think, well, what's the big deal? That's not a huge change. Princess to noble princess, I guess. And so it's actually a little bit more instructive as to why this name was changed. When we look at the account in Genesis chapter 17, this is the time when God is telling Abraham that it's going to be through Sarah that the son of promise, the child of promise, will be born. And God's the one who changes her name. In verse 15, he says, "As for Sarai, your wife, you shall not call her name Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name." And in verse 16, God kind of explains why. He says, "I will bless her, and indeed I will give you a son by her. Then I will bless her, and she shall," notice this, "be a mother of nations," the New American Standard says. "Kings of people will come from her." It's interesting, the idea of a mother is not really in the original Hebrew here. Thus, it's italicized in the New American Standard. Really, the ESV captures it more literally, where it just says that she shall be many nations, or become nations, and kings of people will come from her. But the idea here, connected with this name Sarah, is the idea of indeed nobility or royalty. Nations, kings of nations, are going to arise from her or come through her, through the child that she would bear. It's interesting to me when we look at the sister noun to this word Sarah, the Hebrew word for Sarah, which is a proper noun. I don't know, in English, do we call them improper nouns or common nouns? We just call them nouns, right? Common noun version of this is used in 1 Kings chapter 11 and in verse 3, describing some of the wives of King Solomon. And just notice that text with me, 1 Kings chapter 11, and in verse 3, we read that he had 700 wives, princesses. There's the common noun, not the proper noun for Sarah, but the common noun right there. And 300 concubines and his wives turned his heart away. But it's interesting to me, it seems that these wives of Solomon, who was the king, are described not just as wives, they are princesses. Well, they are married to the king, they are queens, they are royalty. And so that seems to be the idea here with the name change from Sarai to Sarah, is not that she's just a princess, but that she's like a queen. That more importantly, she's going to be a queen who becomes the mother of many kings. And indeed, ultimately, as we trace the line of the seed, that promise to Abraham will ultimately be fulfilled through Jesus Christ, the King of Kings. It's interesting, if you go back there in Genesis chapter 17, her name was not the only name that was changed on this occasion. If you jump back in verse 5, God had previously told Abram, we know him better as Abraham, but at this time his name was Abram. He says to him, no longer shall your name be called Abram, but your name shall be Abraham. For I have made you the father of a multitude of nations. Abram in Hebrew means exalted father. Abraham means a father of multitudes. And so it's interesting on this occasion when God is reaffirming this promise to Abraham that he changes Abram's name to Abraham and he changes Sarai's name to Sarah. But I'm actually getting a little bit ahead of myself here. Let me share with you some more information about Sarah. She was, as we've already indicated, the wife of Abraham. Genesis chapter 11 and verse 29 talks about Abraham choosing her as his wife. She was 10 years the junior of Abraham, so she's 10 years younger than Abraham. And also interesting, she is Abraham's half-sister. They shared a common father, Terah, but they had different mothers. And that may seem strange to us in our culture today, but in the ancient world, that was not uncommon to marry half-siblings that way. And so indeed, they are related not only through marriage, but also through their father. They share a common father. Another thing that's strange to us, but was very common back in this time period, is how long Sarah lived. We learn in Genesis chapter 23 and verse 1 that she lived to the age of 127. And that seems very old to us, but that was actually pretty average for the people that were living in this point in history. Another interesting fact about Sarah is that she was barren. We're told that in Genesis chapter 11 and in verse 30. This means that she was not able to have children. That is, during the years when women would normally be able to bear children, Sarah was unable to conceive and bear any children for Abraham. She was barren. But she was beautiful. In fact, in Genesis chapter 12, notice something that Abraham says to his wife, beginning in verse 11. They're on their journeys here, and they're actually going down into Egypt because the famine in the land of Canaan is severe. And it says in verse 11, it came about when he came near to Egypt, he said to Sarai, his wife, see now, I know that you are a beautiful woman. And when the Egyptians see you, they will say, this is his wife, and they will kill me, but they will let you live. And you know, sometimes beauty is in the eye of the beholder, right? Most of us husbands, we think that our wives are the most beautiful, gorgeous women that have ever walked the face of the earth. I know I feel that way about my Stephanie. But I know that this was not just Abraham's opinion that Sarah was beautiful. If you jump down in the text to verse 14, it came about when Abram came into Egypt. Notice the Egyptians saw that the woman was very beautiful. Beautiful. And I would suggest to you what's interesting to me about this account is we're not talking about a young woman here. At this point in time, Sarah is already over the age of 65. We jump back in the text to verse 4. It says, so Abram went forth as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. Now, Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran and came to the land of Canaan. So when they left Haran, the land of their people, and came to Canaan. Abraham was 75, which means Sarah was 65, if you're doing the math in your head. And now this event happens later, so she's over 65 when Abraham is concerned. My wife is so beautiful that the Egyptians are going to be smitten with her, and they are going to kill me to take my beautiful wife. And indeed, his fear was somewhat well-founded, because when he gets to Egypt, indeed, the Egyptians look at Sarah and they say, wow, she is beautiful. I would suggest to you that Sarah was one of these women who possessed what I call natural beauty. She's not the kind of woman who had to get up in the morning and get out her collection of makeup and get in front of the mirror and doll herself up and do her hair and braid it and put on her ornaments and her jewelry. But I don't get that impression from Sarah. Even, what, from their standpoint, a middle-aged woman. It's just very, very beautiful. So I think it's interesting, keep your finger here in Genesis, but turn with me to 1 Peter chapter 3. Notice this observation that Peter makes to Christian wives. In 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 3, he says to them, your adornment must not be merely external, braiding the hair and wearing gold jewelry or putting on dresses, but let it be the hidden person of the heart with the imperishable quality of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is precious in the sight of God. And notice what he goes on to say about this adorning of women. It's not about the makeup. It's not about your dresses. It's not about your jewelry or your haircut or your hairdo. It's about really the inner person of the heart. But notice this, he says in verse 5, for in this way, in former times, the holy women also, who hoped in God, used to adorn themselves, being submissive to their own husbands, just as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord. It's interesting when Peter is looking for some example of this true beauty, both inwardly and outwardly, not having to do with the adornment of the body, he picks Sarah, the woman known for her beauty. And I think that Sarah was indeed a woman who was beautiful inside and out. But obviously, there was some outward beauty, because the Egyptians, who didn't know her from Eve, thought she was good looking. But there was more to Sarah than that. She is one of only two women mentioned by the Hebrew writer in Hebrews chapter 11 among all the people of faith. Rahab, the harlot, interestingly enough, is mentioned in Hebrews chapter 11 and in verse 31. Sarah, for her part, is mentioned in verse 11. And there the Hebrew writer says, by faith, even Sarah herself received ability to conceive, even beyond the proper time, since she considered him faithful who had promised. And indeed, Sarah was a woman of faith. But notice this, and this is what I hope to flesh out as we look at her story a little bit more this morning. Even though Sarah was a woman of faith, worthy to be listed in that catalog there in Hebrews chapter 11, Sarah was far from a perfect woman. In fact, she was far from being a perfect wife. But she was one who, through her obedience and cooperation with God, possessed what we might call a perfected faith. That was the term that James uses describing Abraham's faith in James chapter 2. That works, working with his faith, by his works, his faith was perfected. It was made complete. It was made whole. And I would suggest to you that Sarah had that same kind of perfected or complete faith that Abraham, her husband, possessed. But what we see here in this idea and in the stories with Sarah is this tension. This tension between the reality of her imperfections on one side, and yet at the same time she was demonstrating a perfect faith towards God. And I think we can see that in several instances, and we can see that tension between those two polar dynamics of her own imperfection contrasted with her perfected faith in some of the events that transpired in her life. The first thing that I'd like to look at is how she demonstrated faithfulness to her husband, Abraham. Go with me to Genesis chapter 12. Beginning in verse 1, this is sometimes what we refer to as the call of Abraham by God. The Lord said to Abraham, "Go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to the land which I will show you, and I'll make you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great so that you shall be a blessing, and I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." God says to Abraham, "I want you to pick up and leave home and go to a place that I'm going to show you. And I'm going to bless you in all of these ways." He talks about, implied here in this text is the idea he's going to get a land. He's also going to have descendants, that nations are going to come through him, and that ultimately through him, everybody in the world will have the opportunity to be blessed. And so oftentimes we read this story and we look at the faith of Abraham, because in verse 6 it says, "So Abram went forth as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot with him. Now Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran, and Abram took Sarai his wife and Lot his nephew and all their possessions which they had accumulated and the persons which they had acquired in Haran, and they set out for the land of Canaan. Thus they came to the land of Canaan." We think, wow, what great faith that Abraham had to set out for a land that he didn't know. In fact, that's what the Hebrew writer says in Hebrews chapter 11 and in verse 8. Go back there with me real quick to Hebrews 11 and just notice the commentary of the Hebrew writer on Abraham's demonstration of faith. It says, "By faith," this is Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 8, "by faith Abraham, when he was called, obeyed by going out to a place which he was to receive for an inheritance, and he went out not knowing where he was going. And by faith he lived as an alien in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, fellow heirs of the same promise, for he was looking for the city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God." And sometimes with this account, we emphasize the faith of Abraham and his demonstration. And you know, even if God had said to Abraham, Abram, I want you to set out from where you are. I want you to go to the land of Canaan. That's the land I'm going to give to you and to your descendants. Even if that's what God had said to him, understand that Abraham had never been to the land of Canaan before. He didn't know where it was at. He didn't know what kind of people lived there. It was a foreign, scary place. He didn't have any of his own people there. And yet God says, "I want you to set out and go to this distant land." But he didn't go alone, did he? He took Sarah, his wife, with him. And what's more is that Sarah seems to have gone with him, apparently without any reservation. Now, wives, think about that for a second. Imagine having this conversation with your husband. How do you think it would turn out? Your husband comes home, he's very excited. Hun, guess what? God talked to me today. It was the coolest experience ever. He spoke to me. He said he was going to bless me. He was going to bless our family. He's going to do all these great things for us. But he said we have to pack up everything and move. Maybe you wives say, "Okay, where are we going? Do you have a better job lined up there? Are we getting a bigger house? What's the neighborhood going to be like? Are the neighbors friendly? How's the weather? Is it going to be hot? Is it going to be cold?" Oh, maybe if we've got kids, we're thinking, "What's the schools like?" All of these kinds of questions run through our minds of these things that we go through and check off. Is it going to be good for us? And your husband responds, "I don't know any of that stuff. I've never been there. I just heard about the place today when God told me about it. I don't know anything about it. All I know is the direction we're supposed to head in. And when we get there, God will tell us when we're there." Would you be willing to just start packing up the tent and heading out? What would it take on your part as a wife to follow the lead of your husband here? Would it not take some trust and confidence in your husband to start packing things up? To move across the state? To move across the country? To move across the world? Would you be willing to follow your husband? I would think that you would also need to put your faith and confidence in your God as well, knowing that this was a command from the Lord. And I believe, guys, that Sarah's willingness to just pick up and go illustrates the fact that her and Abraham had a solid marriage, founded on mutual trust and commitment, both to one another, but more importantly, to their God. And perhaps that's why she is held up as an example of what a godly wife looks like. A wife that Christian wives are supposed to imitate, as we look there in 1 Peter chapter 3. And I would think any man who has a wife like Sarah and has a marriage like Abraham and Sarah had is a blessed man. But the reality is that that doesn't mean that Sarah was a perfect wife, nor a perfect woman, that she never made a mistake. In fact, one might argue that her willingness to listen to Abraham, her husband, and follow his lead, that sometimes she did that when she shouldn't have, when he asked her to do something that was wrong. There are two occasions recorded for us in Genesis. One in the land of Egypt, which we began to read in Genesis chapter 12. And then years later in Gerar in Genesis chapter 20, where Sarah either lies herself about her identity, or at the very least participates in Abraham's lie about who she is. Notice there, if you're still there in Genesis, go to Genesis chapter 12. We read about Abraham's concern of her beauty as they're going down to Egypt. He's afraid that the Egyptians are going to see how beautiful she is and kill him. We skipped over verse 13 where Abraham asks her to do something. He says, "Please say that you are my sister so that it may go well with me because of you and that I may live on account of you. If they know that I'm married to you, they might kill me so that they can take you to be their wife. I don't want to die, so please just tell them you're my sister." Now, that's technically a half-truth, right? They shared the same father, but had different mothers. But I would suggest to you that even a half-truth is a whole lie. And on both occasions, in Genesis chapter 12 in Egypt and in the land of Gerar in Genesis chapter 20, because of this deception that she follows her husband in, Sarah herself is put in very compromising situations. Pharaoh's officials saw her, verse 15, and they praised her to Pharaoh, and the woman was taken into Pharaoh's house. Therefore, he treated Abram well for her sake and gave him sheep and oxen and donkeys and male and female servants and female donkeys and camels. And we might think everything's working out well. God did not think so. God has to step in here and intervene to protect Sarah, to protect the promises that he's made to Abraham. We read in verse 17, "The Lord struck Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarah, Abraham's wife." And then Pharaoh called Abraham and said, "What is this you've done to me? Why did you not tell me she was your wife? Why did you say she's my sister so that I took her to be my wife? Now then, here's your wife. Take her and go." And he kind of escorts him out of Egypt. And the same thing happens years later in the land of Gerar with Abimelech. The king sees her beauty, takes her into his harem. God this time intervenes in a dream and tells Abimelech, he says, "Don't you dare touch her because she's another man's wife." And he restores her to Abraham on that occasion. But it just illustrates this tension a woman who has great faith, even faithfulness to her husband, and yet even in that there is some imperfection. Sometimes she listens when she should not. But we also see Sarah's faith demonstrated in towards God in relation specifically to God's promises regarding Abraham's descendants. Go with me to Genesis chapter 15. This really is a reiteration of the promises to Abraham, but it's with more clarity here. It says, after these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision, saying, do not fear, Abram. I am your shield. Your reward shall be very great. And Abram says, I know, Lord. I know that you've made those promises to me. But what will you give me? Because I'm childless, and the heir of my house is Eleazar of Damascus. Abram said, since you have given no offspring to me, one born in my house is my heir. Right? Abraham knew that the promises God made implied that he would have an heir, a descendant, someone who would come after him. And the custom of the day was, when you don't have any children of your own, you would kind of adopt the eldest slave in your family, and they would inherit your wealth when you passed away. And Abram's saying, the only heir I have is Eliezer, my servant. And God says to him here, this man will not be your heir, but one who will come forth from your own body, he shall be your heir. And he took him outside and said, now look toward the heavens and count the stars if you're able to count them. And he said to him, so shall your descendants be. And he believed in the Lord, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. This is a time when Abraham demonstrates that faith in God. He believed God, and it was credited to him as righteousness. That this heir would come through his body. And I could imagine that Abram would go home and tell Sarah about this. Honey, God said that my descendant is not going to be Eliezer. I know we thought that was the plan, but it's not going to be Eliezer. He said, I'm actually going to have a child, that he's going to be from me. And Sarah says to herself, well, we got a problem there, hon, because I'm barren. I have never been able to have children. We've tried all throughout the years, and I've never gotten pregnant. It just doesn't work. It's not in the cards. And so Sarah, I think, because she does believe the promises of God, but she sees her own inability to be a part of that, tries to help God fulfill his promise. And so we read in Genesis chapter 16 that Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne no children, and she had an Egyptian maid whose name was Hagar. And so Sarai said to Abram, now behold, the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. Please go into my maid. Perhaps I will bring up children through her. And Abram listened to the voice of Sarah. And after Abram had lived 10 years in the land of Canaan, Abram's wife Sarah took Hagar the Egyptian, her maid, and gave her to her husband Abram as his wife. So they've been in the land of Canaan for 10 years. If my math is correct, Sarah is now 75. She still hasn't had a child. And we think, when we look at this story, this is crazy. That she would give her slave, another woman, to her husband and say, I can't have kids for you, but maybe she can have some kids. Understand that that's not exactly what's happening here. The custom of the day was that if the mistress, the woman of the house, could not, for whatever reason, bear children, the custom was that her servants would function as surrogates for her. They didn't have the marvel of modern medicine that we do today. So they did it the old-fashioned way. And the husband would impregnate the servant, but that child that was conceived was not supposed to be the servant's child. It was to be the mistress's child. She would bear children through her servants. And that's what the text is suggesting here to us. And so even though that's strange and foreign to us, remember, these are a foreign people, an ancient people with different customs. And that was how they did it. Unfortunately, though, for Sarah, her plan backfires rather quickly. Because her maidservant, Hagar, when she realizes that she has become pregnant by Abram. She becomes a little bit of an attitude towards Sarah. We read in verse 4, he went into Hagar and she conceived, and when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress was despised in her sight. It would seem that Hagar was perhaps not wanting to live up to her portion of this arrangement. She saw this is my opportunity to show up my mistress. I can do something that she cannot do, that she's never been able to do. And this irritates Sarah. Sarah said to Abram in verse 5, may the wrong done me be upon you. I gave my maid into your arms, but when she saw that she had conceived, I was despised in her sight. May the Lord judge between you and me. But Abram said to Sarah, behold, your maid is in your power. Do to her what is good in your sight. So Sarah treated her harshly, and she fled from her presence. It's kind of a different side of Sarah that we see here. An angry, frustrated, bitter side. Now, I'm not saying that Hagar was innocent in this situation. I think she was trying to usurp Sarah's position. And that's why Sarah got frustrated. But to treat her so harshly that she felt that she had no other means but to run away, that's rough. And again, we see God intervening here to bring back Hagar, telling her to submit to Sarah, to submit to her authority, to bring this child for Abraham. Ultimately, the child would become Ishmael, and he too would be blessed as a descendant, though not the son of promise. It would be another 13 years before God would speak to Abraham again, informing him that the son of promise would not only come through Abraham, but it would come through Sarah, his wife. It was on this occasion in Genesis chapter 17 that God changed their names that we've already read about. But it's in verse 19 that God makes it very clear to Abraham. Because Abraham's bargain, just let Ishmael be the son of promise. And God says, no, but Sarah, your wife, will bear you a son, and you shall call his name Isaac, and I'll establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant for his descendants after him. And again, Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. I like the way that Paul talks about this event in Romans chapter 3. Romans chapter 4. Even citing some of these prophecies or these promises made to Abraham. Verse 17, as is written, a father of many nations I have made you. In the presence of him who believed, even God who gives life to the dead and calls into being what does not exist. And speaking of Abraham, he says in verse 18, in hope against hope, Abraham believed so that he might become the father of many nations according to that which had been spoken. So shall your descendants be. And without becoming weak in faith, he contemplated his own body, now as good as dead, since he was about 100 years old, and the deadness of Sarah's womb. And yet with respect to the promise of God, he did not waver in unbelief, but grew strong in faith, giving glory to God and being fully assured that what God had promised, he was able also to perform. Now again, we look at this account and we think, wow, look at that great demonstration of Abraham's faith. But it takes two to tango. Abraham, even though he contemplates his body, says, I'm an old man. I'm past the time when I should be having kids. My wife, Sarah, she's never had children. But God said, me and Sarah are going to have a kid. He did what was necessary to have a child. But so did Sarah. What's interesting to me is the indication in the text as you go back to Genesis chapter 18 when the visitors come and it's really the angels and they tell Abraham that this time next year we're going to come back and Sarah will have a child and Sarah's in the tent and she laughs, right? It's interesting. We read in Genesis chapter 18 and verse 11. Now Abraham and Sarah were old, advanced in age. Sarah was, New American Standard says, past childbearing. Literally, it means that she was past the manner of a woman. Well, the only other time that kind of a phrase is used in Genesis is in Genesis chapter 31, In verse 35, when Rachel doesn't get off the saddle of the donkey because she's hiding her father's household idols, and she says to him, "Oh, I'm sorry, Dad. My time of the month is on me, and I can't get up." She says, "The manner of woman is upon me, and I cannot arise." But the idea here is that Sarah, even if she had not been barren all of her life, at this point, at 90 years old, she's already gone through menopause. Even if she could have had children, at this point, it is absolutely, unequivocally, physically impossible for her to have a child. She is past the manner of a woman. I think that's probably why she laughs. Which, by the way, she's not the only one who laughed when she was informed that she would have a child. Abraham also laughed. But the point is, just as Abraham did not grow weak in faith, but put his trust and confidence in the promises of God, believing the thing that God had promised, God was able to fulfill, so too did Sarah. So just as Abraham demonstrated a perfected faith, Sarah also demonstrated a perfected faith in regards to the conception of Isaac. It was clearly through God's intervention, but they had to cooperate with one another in order for it to happen. And you notice the angel's responses there in Genesis chapter 18, when she laughs and the Lord says to Abraham, verse 13, "Why did Sarah laugh, saying, 'Shall I indeed bear a child when I am so old?'" Notice verse 14, "Is anything too difficult for the Lord?" That reminds me of what Jesus says in Mark chapter 10 and in verse 27. After he's talked about how hard it is for a rich man to enter into the kingdom of heaven, "It's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter." And his disciples are like, "Well, who could be saved?" And Jesus looked at them in verse 27 and said, "With people it's impossible, but not with God, for all things are possible with God." Abraham believed that. Sarah believed that. And they acted upon their faith, putting their faith in God, realizing that nothing is impossible for him. One thing that jumps out at me, men, when I think about Sarah as a wife here, as a woman, we need to recognize that our wife's value is not based on her ability to always do everything right. Your wife doesn't have to be perfect to be a perfect wife. Rather, all she needs to do is to be willing to faithfully follow God. And I think that there is a lesson in that for all of us, both men and women. When God calls us to do what seems to be impossible, though we may have our doubts and our apprehensions, though we may question God's plan or God's purpose, things which, by the way, it's not wrong for us to question. It's not wrong for us to have some doubts. We may even stumble and fall as we try to perform what God wants us to do. Maybe we grow impatient with God's timing, or we improvise thinking maybe this is what God wants me to do. But when we recognize our shortcomings, when we realize we've stumbled, we get back up and we continue to try to do what God has instructed, putting our faith in his promises. And if we'll do that, we too can gain the victory and be rewarded just as Sarah was rewarded. Let us not forget that nothing is impossible for God as long as we are willing to put our faith and our trust in him. And if we will obey him, he can accomplish great things through us.